What does a $6 billion credit card settlement mean for you?
And there's a new watchdog for the companies that watch your credit. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, July 16th. Coming up, we're also going to go to Kazakhstan, which it turns out has become the new Cape Canaveral since NASA is having to pay the Russians to launch astronauts into space.
We'll talk about what that LIBOR scandal we've talked so much about lately might have to do with the oil industry. And Alan Sloan is going to stop by. He's promised a definitive answer on the question of whether private equity firms like Bain Capital are job destroyers or job creators. Stick around. It's on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
We will start with the largest antitrust class action settlement in U.S. history. The major credit card companies, Visa and MasterCard, as well as the big banks, have agreed to pay more than $6 billion to retailers. The retailers had argued that the credit companies conspired to fix the prices that retailers have to pay when people buy things with credit cards.
The settlement would change the rules and allow retailers to charge you more if you use a credit card for your purchase. Mallory Duncan is general counsel and senior vice president at the National Retail Federation, and he joins us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
How big of a deal is this thing?
It's pretty big. You know, swipe fees amount to about $400 per household every year in hidden fees. We should all be outraged that we're having to pay it. And this was an attempt to bring that down. But it looks like, at least on first read, it's going to fall real short.
You don't think this is good for retailers?
Potentially, it's not good for retailers or for our customers. The banks have been charging a huge hidden swipe fee for the last several years. Amounts to tens of billions of dollars a year. This settlement provides some compensation for the overcharges in the past, and it portends to offer tools to try to bring those swipe fees down in the future. But frankly, after about an eight-month hiatus, those fees are going to start going right back up again because the tools are ineffective.
And you think that those fees are going to be passed on to consumers?
The swipe fees, consumers are paying them now. They're buried in the price of everything we all buy. And the goal here was to try to get those fees down. You can't have supposedly competitive banks all getting together and through their associations charging exactly the same fee to everybody without any negotiation. And that's what the case was supposed to fix.
Well, then why did the retailers that were involved in the settlement agree with it?
Well, actually, the agreement as between the attorneys for the banks and the attorneys supposedly representing the retailers. And you've already seen some of the retailers involved in the suit say, we're not happy with this. And from the calls and comments I've gotten over the weekend, they're going to be joined by more.
Mallory Duncan of the National Retail Federation, thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure, happy to do it.
The credit card settlement isn't the only big credit and consumer finance story bumping around today. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, said this morning it will assume oversight of the credit reporting industry. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Retail merchants stand to get most of the settlement money, and the credit card industry will cut the fees they charge to process transactions when you and I swipe. Economist Mike Mebs in the Chicago area says it puts a dent in the market power of the plastic industry, namely Visa.
The Visa board really controls pricing process. This is, at the minimum, a very tight oligopoly, almost a cartel.
The settlement lets merchants tell the public how much the credit card companies charge them in fees. Merchants can also give discounted prices to cash customers. Bert Fohr at the Antitrust Institute, a think tank, thinks it all injects competition into the payment system, which no longer will be dictated by the banks.
The swipe fee, that will go down, and eventually that will result in lower prices.
When and if this takes effect is subject to the lawyers. A group representing convenience stores says they'll reject the deal, and it all has to be approved in court before anything takes effect. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Looks like we'll still be saying the word LIBOR with some regularity this week. The investigation continues into whether banks manipulated that key interest rate. And more broadly, people are starting to look at whether something like the LIBOR scandal could happen again.
The whole scandal really boiled down to this. A market price that we all rely on was based largely on self-reporting. So not cold, hard data, but human beings saying what their data showed. Could other parts of our economy be subject to the same risk? Probably. In the UK today, lawmakers are highlighting an overlooked G20 report that says oil price reporting has some uncomfortable similarities to the LIBOR situation. Marketplace's London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is with us. Hello.
Hello, Jeff.
What are the mechanics by which the price we pay for oil could theoretically be manipulated a la LIBOR?
Well, as with LIBOR, we arrive at a daily price for oil as a result of its oil traders reporting the price at which they're buying and selling crude. And the G20 study says these traders have an incentive to talk up or talk down the price. In other words, they could manipulate the market.
Is there any actual evidence of it?
No, no evidence, just a suspicion, a concern. But a couple of analysts I was talking to here this morning are skeptical this has happened. They make the point this is a much bigger exercise than the LIBOR reporting. Dozens and dozens of oil traders are consulted, and the information is gathered by journalists, so much more difficult to rig.
So let's pivot before I let you go to some other oil market news. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia just opened new pipelines that bypass this narrow little choke point of entry to the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, because the Strait is, as somebody once said, the jugular vein of the West. It carries a third of the world's oil shipped by sea, and Iran has repeatedly threatened to close the Strait. These new pipelines double the amount of oil that bypass the Strait to 6.5 million barrels a day. So that does reduce Iran's power to blackmail the West. But Nick McGregor of stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley says it certainly doesn't eliminate the Iranian threat.
Iran's control over the Straits of Hormuz is still going to be massively of concern to the Americans and to the West. The volumes of oil that go through are still very, very significant.
And he says in a relatively tight market, the oil price would shoot up if Iran did close the strait.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff.
Last week, China reported its slowest pace of economic growth in 3 years. But over the weekend, the country revealed a silver lining. Wages for urban households in China rose 13% in the first half of this year. And as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, that could be good news for the U.S. economy.
More money in the pockets of Chinese workers means more domestic buying power. And more buying power from the world's fastest rising consumer class is good for U.S. businesses, says CLSA economist Andy Rothman, who works in Shanghai.
If you look at the big U.S. companies that have invested here recently, the really large-scale investment, people like Ford or GM, they're all selling here. They're not exporting.
Rothman says for U.S. companies, you don't even have to relocate to China to get in on the rising buying power of the Chinese.
If you look at the growth rate of U.S. exports to China since they joined the WTO, it's up over 500%. And one of the reasons for that is that wages have been going up, which means people can afford to buy more American goods.
Here's one glaring example. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is forecasting that this year China's going to pass Canada to become the largest single market for U.S. agricultural exports. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, there's a spaceship somewhere between Earth and the International Space Station right about now. It's got a NASA astronaut on board, but it was launched from Kazakhstan on a Russian rocket.
NASA has been paying Russia to get astronauts into space since retiring the shuttle. For more, we're joined by Abdujalil Abdurasulov, who is with the BBC in Kazakhstan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, describe the launch site and tell us what it's like there.
It's a very surreal place. Imagine a vast, vast Kazakh steppe in the middle of nowhere. It's a vast emptiness, basically. And right in the middle, you can see a tiny, small rocket. And everybody else, all the observers, they have to stand quite far from the launching site, maybe about 4 kilometers away on a wooden benches and some concrete platforms. So that's the view of the launching site.
And, you know, from the American perspective, this whole deal is a little embarrassing, probably, that we have to rely on Russian rockets to get our astronauts into space. What's the view from the Russian point of view?
Well, the Russians, the Roscosmos, the Russian Space Agency, is certainly proud that the only agency that is able to launch the flights, the manned flights. And if you look at it, it's quite impressive. The actual rocket and the capsule as well, they were designed in the 1960s. Hmm. And they're still the most reliable vehicles today. But I think in a few years' time, maybe in the nearest future, there will be private companies as well who will be able to send humans to the space, including to the ISS as well. Because just recently, a private company, SpaceX, managed to send a cargo vessel to the ISS. So that's the first step, maybe, for the private manned flights.
But for now, of course, we're using the Russian rockets to get NASA astronauts into space. What are we paying them for that privilege?
At the moment, NASA is paying about $51 million per astronaut, maybe. But in a few years' time, starting from 2014, NASA will pay about $63 million per seat. And in total, they will pay about $750 million for 12 round trips.
Abdujalil Abdurasulov joining us from Kazakhstan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, last week we told you about the best places in the country for business. Now there's a new survey that ranks America's manliest cities, Jeff. It comes from the website bestplaces.net, and it uses metrics like number of pro sports teams, number of NASCAR tracks and racing events, number of barbecue restaurants, home improvement stores, and steakhouses.
At least they're not being too stereotypical about
it. Exactly. Well, the winners this year are Oklahoma City at number 3, Charlotte at number 2, and Nashville at number 1. New York is 35 on the list, right. And I'm just guessing that...
Los Angeles, where I am? What about that?
You're dead last at 50.
What?
This is Sorry.
Los Angeles is the least manly city.
The least
city
manly
in the
city,
States.
According to this idiotic study.
They're going to put that on the sign welcoming you to town. Well, nothing more manly than a classic sports car. Well, maybe a few things like barbecues and Home Depot stores. But 40 years ago, somebody stole an Austin Healey sports car from this guy. His name is Robert Russell. And every now and then, as we got into the age of the internet, he just makes sort of a half-hearted attempt to poke around for this car that he's always been nostalgic for. So the other day, boom, on eBay, he finds it. It's being listed by a car dealership in Beverly Hills, completely legitimately. I mean, they didn't steal it, but they had it. And this is the crazy thing to me. All these years, 40 years, Bob never lost or got rid of his car title.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so, piece of cake. It's his car. He's got the title. Man and machine.
Still got it.
Happily reunited.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Many of you might remember a basketball player by the name of Jeremy Lin. He's a point guard for the New York Knicks. He had an incredible string of games in this past season. He was undrafted, kind of a Cinderella story. He's also Asian American and went to Harvard, both of which makes him something of a rarity in the NBA. Okay, so there are now fears that Linsanity, as the phenomenon around him was called, may officially be over or at least be transferred somewhere else because the Knicks may be letting him go to the Houston Rockets.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Roger Groves. He's a contributor at Forbes and director of the Center for Sports and Social Entrepreneurship. Hi, Roger.
Hello, everyone.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that the Knicks are going to let him go? And if so, why?
Well, I think they probably will let him go. And I think the decision probably was already made when they acquired Raymond Felton.
And Felton plays the same position as Lin. I mean, that's the critical thing here, right? We're talking about two point guards.
I think the other, even more critical possibly, is the fact that Lin unfortunately had, the 35 games and 25 starts, but then has torn cartilage and didn't play in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Comparably, Raymond Felton he's a seven-year vet.
But Linsanity, right? I mean,
right.
The money, the hype, the excitement around this guy that they experienced in New York, can that just be transferred to Houston or is it gone from our lives forever?
I think that depends on winning. I mean, remember, even with the Tebow kinds of euphoria that they had, they also were happened to win during that time and he still got traded. And I think it's important to think about from a business perspective, if you're going to match an offer and you've got it backloaded, if you're dealing with that, then you're dealing with a relatively high fixed cost on a speculative product or an asset. And without winning, and remember Houston did not do so well last year. And so without winning, it's hard to justify that risk.
Even if you've got a huge Chinese following that just loves watching the games just because it's Jeremy Lin.
And I would say from a business perspective, from Houston's perspective, look how many other entities they would have to share that revenue split with. It's one thing having a revenue split tied into a collective bargaining agreement where you've only got a few players. But, of course, with the kind of Linsanity, even if it were transferable, you've got everybody who's involved in merchandising with a piece of that split. You've got TV contracts. And if they don't win, then you don't have as large a TV market. And as we all know, that's a huge component of long-term revenue.
You're being diplomatic here, Roger, but I read between the lines that you don't think Houston is making a great decision by putting all this money on the table for Jeremy Lin.
I think I could go so far to say that it has surprised, raised eyebrows, and maybe even stunned some that they would have that kind of a backloaded contract where someone coming off knee surgery that has started 25 games in non-playoff action is going to be worth that 3 years down the road. And frankly, we don't have the demographics and the history precedent within the NBA to know what is the value of the marketing dollars for the team when you have such a speculative market that may end up not being one that is a highly successful team.
Roger Groves is director of the Center for Sports and Social Entrepreneurship, also a contributor to Forbes. Good to talk with you, Roger. Thanks.
Thank you.
Microsoft has called a mystery news conference today, and the speculation is that the company will unveil new features for its software suite, Office 15. As our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, Microsoft is trying hard to stay ahead of its rivals.
Microsoft has taken notice of the competition from Google Docs, a cloud-based alternative that snatched away a growing number of users. The software giant recently launched its own cloud-based response.
Unlike Google Docs, Office Web Apps keeps the formatting and style of your Office documents just the way you want them.
Then there's the iPad, which runs Apple's Office-style apps, but not Microsoft Office. There will be Office apps on Microsoft's own upcoming line of tablets, but analysts have been left to guess whether it'll be offered for the iPad. Charles King is with the research firm Pundit.
You look at the number of not just consumers, but business users that are fans of the iPad, and it would make great sense from a business perspective for Microsoft to embrace those customers.
Microsoft's toughest competition, though, could be Microsoft itself, as analyst Jack Gold sees it.
The bigger risk is they don't make the new version attractive enough for people to upgrade, and so they just stay with what they've got.
For Microsoft, it's a game of can you top this, played on several different fronts. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This morning, the media plunged right back into this controversy over when exactly Mitt Romney left his top job at Bain Capital. But the debate also veered back toward the bigger Bain-related question that will probably persist right through Election Day. Job creator or job destroyer? And that question's bigger than Bain, it's bigger than Romney, probably bigger than any one election. Fortune magazine senior editor-at-large Alan Sloan has been thinking about it. He's here with me now. Good to talk with you.
My pleasure, Jeff.
First of all, Bain Capital, it's one of a breed of firms, these leveraged buyout or private equity outfits. In a general sense, what do these companies do?
These companies buy companies using a lot of borrowed money and then try to sell them in a few years down the road for more than they paid for it.
And we should be clear, these companies, like, let's be honest, all private companies exist largely to make a profit. Right?
Right. Well, these buyout companies, which call themselves now private equity because that's a classier term, the buyout companies exist, as I write in Fortune, to make money for their investors and for themselves, not necessarily in that order.
So, Alan, job creators or job destroyers? You are the senior editor at large here. You ought to have the venerability to be the referee on this. What do you say?
Well, the answer is nobody has any reliable job statistics because nobody wants to know. If you're running a buyout company and you can make more money expanding something you've bought, well, you'll do that and happily add jobs. If you make more money loading up the company with debt and taking a payment out and putting everyone at risk, will you do that? And finally, if it turns out there's an extra 3 cents to be made by closing the whole company and moving the operations to China, you'll do that too. They don't care. They're not bad people. They're not moral. They're not immoral. They're what's known as amoral. They're in it for the money. And there are no statistics because nobody wants there to be any statistics. So nobody keeps them.
Well, we put an end to this debate here today, haven't we, Alan?
Heaven willing, we have, but I wouldn't bet your salary on it.
Alan Sloan, more on this topic in his upcoming Fortune column. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Now to the Times of London, Jeff, which had an unusual request in its editorial on Saturday. Please stop raining.
Heavy-duty news cycle in London, apparently.
That's right. Well, the newspaper said, let us make our position crystal clear. We are against this weather. It must stop raining, and soon. Unfortunately, I guess Mother Nature doesn't read the Times. It is currently, at the time of this podcast broadcast, raining in London.
And it wasn't that rain that ended the Bruce Springsteen concert in Hyde Park over the weekend in London. So here's how it went down. Bruce is taking an encore. It's about 11 p.m., and this might be the best part. He had just pulled Paul McCartney up on stage. You know, all these concerts, they're always like, oh, look who's here, Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, famous person, come up and do songs you did a zillion times. It was one of those moments, and they were going to do some Beatles tunes. So Springsteen and McCartney on stage in Hyde Park, tens of thousands of people, and then somebody turns the mics off. Just turns them off on these huge artists. And Hyde Park, you see, has a 10:30 curfew. You're already half hour over because it's very noisy and a lot of wealthy people live around Hyde Park. And so they've been clamping down and there have already been penalties that have kept concert promoters from staging more concerts there next year because it's just too much. So the organizers just pulled the plug.
You don't pull the plug on Springsteen and McCartney. That's my rule of thumb, usually, when I run concerts. But anyway, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.